Our scripture reading is Psalm 95, verses 1 through 11, which is the whole psalm. O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath that they shall not enter my rest. This is the word of the Lord. So I've been a parent for about 2 weeks, and each day so far I've realized that there's more and more that I don't really know what I'm doing. It's very clear at this point that I'm not an expert, but there's one thing that everyone tells you that's been very true so far, and that's how important sleep is when you have a newborn. Everyone's asking me about it this morning. Everyone this week, when they came by the church, they said something like, Tim, you look terrible. Tim, you look like you're not getting any sleep. You look haggard and crazy. And I think, and I hope that they mean that I look tired and not that I just generally look terrible. But sleep is really important. Without it, everything else kind of falls apart. Jenny and I have both had some of these episodes already. One night, Jenny woke up thinking not only was she feeding Andrew, but that she had also given birth to another child that she was feeding and that we had not named yet for some reason, so she could only call him the sibling. I woke up one morning realizing that I fully believed that I had been walking Andrew outside in the middle of the night and had a very pleasant conversation with the talking bear. And that did not happen, but I didn't even think it was notable. See, when you don't sleep, everything else falls apart. It's really an ordering principle in the life of a newborn and in the life of a newborn's family. Other things are important, but sleep is this visible variable that affects everything else. I think that's what worship is in the church. What we do here on Sunday mornings is this visible variable, this visible aspect of the church, and it bleeds into all of the other aspects. Fellowship, discipleship, mission, all of those things are important, but I think that without worship, I doubt many of us would participate in them. And that's what our psalm is about this week, about worship. In fact, throughout the history of the church, this psalm has been used as a call to worship, because it brings us into proper alignment, and it gives us kind of a theology of worship, a deeper understanding. The great preacher Charles Spurgeon wrote of this psalm that it has about it a ring like that of church bells, and like the bells, it sounds both merrily and solemnly, at first ringing out a lively peal and then dropping into a funeral knell, as if tolling at the funeral of the generation which perished in the wilderness. And so we call it the Psalm of the Provocation. See, this psalm gives us a theology of worship. What should worship look like? How should we go about worshiping? How should we apply worship to the rest of our lives outside of the sanctuary? And so that's what I want to look at this week. First, we're going to look at what it teaches us about worship. We must order our worship first around joyful praise, second with humble reverence, and finally with an obedient response. First, the psalm shows us that worship should be expressed in a joyful praise. The psalm begins, O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. And so the joyful praise really get at two important aspects of worship. First, the direction of worship, and second, the attitude of worship. The direction of worship is clearly supposed to be towards the Lord. We should sing our praises to God, meaning it's not really about whether Matt or I feel good about the music or what the sounds like or whether we personally respond to it, but which direction is that praise pointed? I think this is really hard for us. Worship, especially worship music, has become incredibly consumeristic in our lives. We're all guilty of this. We want music that moves us, that fits our personal preferences, and that's delivered or performed with excellence. And this manifests in many different ways. I remember a church I used to work at, I had a congregant who came up to me one Sunday and was very upset about the worship music. And she came because she told me that only certain musical instruments should be used in worship because they were she was certain about which musical instruments would be in heaven. So there's not any drums or banjos in heaven, Tim, so there shouldn't be drums or banjos in worship. In fact, she was very confident that the only musical instruments that should be allowed in worship were organs, pianos, brass, woodwinds, harps, and violins. That was her list. Everything else should be out of bounds. See, a lot of churches decide to only sing scripture songs, or some churches only sing modern music, trying to aim at visitors instead of God. But what the psalm shows is that worship is really not for us. It is for God, and that should move our worship from focusing on a performance for our benefit to a participation for His glory. It also speaks to the attitude of worship, that it should be joyful and enjoyable. You know, that God cares about the heart when worshiping. It should never be a chore or something you have to do, but an emotional outpouring of the joy you experience. C.S. Lewis wrote about this, saying, "I think we delight to praise what we enjoy, because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. It is an appointed consummation. It is not out of compliment that lovers keep on telling one another how beautiful they are. The delight is incomplete until it is expressed. Just like it is frustrating to have discovered a new author and not to be able to tell anyone how good he is, to come suddenly at the turn of the road upon a beautiful mountain valley of unexpected grandeur, and then have to keep silent because the people with you care for it no more than for a tin can in the ditch, to hear a good joke and to find no one to share it with." What he's saying is that our joy, our enjoyment, is not complete until it's expressed. Our joy in God should be overflowing our own hearts and minds so that we have no choice but to let it pour out in praise. There's a video on YouTube of this Norwegian explorer. His name is Alexander Gamme, I think. And he went on a solo hike in Antarctica. So he started at the coast and he walked by himself to the South Pole and then he walked back. And as he walked towards the South Pole, he would bury these little care packages of first aid kits and food for his return journey, because it lightened his load on the way, and then he had something to tide him over on his way back. In this video, he's on day 86 out of his 87 days of walking back. So it's his last kind of cache of stuff that he had buried. And at this point, it's been months, and he doesn't remember what he buried. So he starts digging through the snow, and he has the video watching him, and at first he uncovers some basic first aid needs. He's not that excited. It's like, oh, great. And then he comes to a bag of cheese doodles and a chocolate bar, and he just loses it. He is so excited. He has so much joy in that moment that he can't contain it, and so he's just screaming in joy in this empty tundra landscape. And that's what our praise should look like, a recognition of the amazing gifts that we have received and the providence of God that manifests in a joy that surpasses anything that we could imagine or experience on our own, a joy that shines through what we're wearing or what we're singing or what happened to us this past week or what might be distracting us this morning. It's an exuberant and transforming joy. Second, this psalm shows us how worship should include a deep and a humble reverence. Derek Kidner is an Old Testament scholar, I like a lot, and he said that this reverence is the deep and basic note of worship, without which the joyful noise would be shrill and self-indulgent. He's saying that the reverence is the reason for the joy. The psalm, it gives us for the joyful praise, because our Lord is a great God who far exceeds all of the other gods, who has greatness above all things, even the heights and the depths of the natural world which he created. John Calvin pointed out that while the immediate audience here might have thought that the psalmist was speaking to God's greatness compared to the other gods of ancient times that other people worshipped, he's really drawing a contrast between him and the false gods that men create for themselves. See, our worship should be based on this fact that God is greater and a better investment than all of our own self-created gods. Gods of success, of happiness, of comfort, of material wealth and personal security. All of the things which we treat as functional gods, whether that we invest our time in, like family members or friends or retirement or political activism or even religious involvement in the church, pale in comparison to the sureness of God. That's why the psalm calls him the rock of salvation, because he is solid, he is dependable, he is sure, and he is trustworthy. Every aspect of nature falls under his creation and his care. I remember when I worked at a church in Williamsburg, Virginia for a while, and we hired a new contemporary worship leader, and he had been in a Canadian Christian rock band for like a decade, and he was very talented. He could play a lot of instruments. His name was Glenn, and the only problem with Glenn is that because he had been in a rock band for his whole adult life, he didn't own a suit, he didn't own a tie, and he didn't own any slacks. And so he would get up and do a great job of leading worship, but he did so in jeans. And there were people at this church who were very upset. They were very offended by the denim. And I remember some of them came up to the senior pastor, my mentor Bill, and they said, "Bill, what are you going to do about Glenn's jeans? How are you going to fix this problem?" And I'll never forget Bill's answer, because he just said, "I didn't notice. My eyes were closed during worship." And that's a great answer, because it gets to this reverence of worship. That instead of being preoccupied by things that seem like reverence, like fake reverence, like who was wearing what or standing where or singing this song versus that song, we should be focused on real reverence, on humbling ourselves before God. What does this look like for us? What does this look like at Fairview? Are our Sundays full of this humility and adoration and reverence? When we walk in on Sunday morning, are we humbling ourselves before the Lord, or are we trying to look and seem our best to impress each other or even to impress God with our commitment? Are we centering our worship on reverence to his holiness, or are we turning God into another thing on our to-do list, a person we call when we're in trouble? I know a lot of people in this area grew up Catholic, and I find this very rich in the Catholic tradition, the deep reverence for God that they have. Too often, as Protestants, we treat God so casually, so friendly, and we treat him less powerfully and as less holy. But worship should be about his greatness, because we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Not only did he create all that we are in the world around us, but he has provided for us again and again. Brother Lawrence was a 17th century French monk who wrote a book called The Practice of the Presence of God that people in the church still read today. In it he wrote, "To worship God in truth is further to admit that we are entirely contrary to him, and that he is willing to make us like himself if we desire it. Who will be so imprudent to turn himself away, even for a moment, from the reverence, the love, the service, and the continual adoration which we justly owe him?" See, the reverence is based on who he is compared to who we are. And it's very logical, but it can also be transformative in our lives and in our worship. Finally, the psalm shows us that proper worship requires an obedient response. You know, last weekend, I was in Blacksburg, Virginia for a friend's wedding. And after the ceremony, one of my friend's relatives came up to me and started talking to me about gender roles in marriage. And these conversations happen to me occasionally. And you meet someone who feels very strongly about their stance on a husband's headship over the wife and what that looks like in terms of a marriage and the church, and usually that person feels very passionately about their position, and I don't very much enjoy these conversations, because normally once they find out if we disagree about something, then they spend the rest of the night trying to convince me that I'm wrong, and it's just not an enjoyable way to spend a wedding. So my friend's relative came up and he starts saying, my wife and I, when we got married about 60 years ago, we agreed at the beginning that I would make all the big decisions and she would be allowed to make all the small decisions. And so at this point, I am like, okay, I'm going to try and get out of this conversation. I'm looking around the room to see who can save me. And then he says, now we've been married for almost 60 years and there hasn't been a big decision yet. So he completely caught me by surprise. He was setting me up with this conversation that I've had 100 times that I don't enjoy having. And then he lulled me to sleep before bringing something that really surprised me. I think that that's a part of this where the reverence and the joy is expected when we talk about worship. You have all heard this before. Your eyes might have glazed over when I said the worship is about making a joyful noise and about having a reverent adoration for God. But the response and the obedience, I don't think, is something we always connect with worship. Let's look back at the text where the psalmist reminds us of the relationship between God and his people. He said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and they put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath that they shall not enter my rest. He's reminding us of how disobedience and apathy has pervaded our entire history, how none of this is new, and how our ancestors were disobedient, and what that disobedience looks like. When he references Meribah and Massa, he's referring back to Exodus 17, where after Moses had brought the people out of Egypt and into the desert, they had run out of water, and people were quarreling with Moses over the lack of water. And finally they came to Moses and they said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in the hand, the staff which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massa and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not? So that's what he's referring to. Meribah literally means dispute. Massa means testing. He's saying that despite being the people of his pasture, our ancestors tested God. They disputed with him. They were disobedient and forgetful and apathetic. And here the psalmist is warning us not to do the same thing, not to make the same mistake, not to harden our hearts to God and to worship. Because we still do this in our lives. How often do we disregard God's commands and guidelines to serve our own self-interest? Well, some of us, we might miss church to catch up with friends or family or work or sleep. We'll bring our own preferences and opinions into worship instead of focusing on Him. Many of us come to church each Sunday, but we keep worship compartmentalized, separate from the rest of our lives. So we don't let it affect what happens when we leave the sanctuary. This is something that's happened throughout the history of Christianity. Sometimes I think back to, you talk about slave owners or Nazis or members of the KKK, people who went to church regularly, who seemed like committed Christians, yet that didn't stop them from committing atrocities outside of the sanctuary. On a more specific level, we've all known Christians who steal, who abuse, who cheat on their spouse or their taxes. I remember one friend who had a Christian bumper sticker on his car, but if you were on the road next to him, you surely would not experience God's grace. But what is worship, really, without obedience? What's at the end of that road? For the God's people in the Old Testament, God punished them by not letting them enter his rest, by not letting them experience his Sabbath. So how should we respond? How can we make sure that we don't miss out on entering the rest? The psalm was used directly, was directly quoted in chapter 3 and 4 of Hebrews, where the author writes, don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion and on the day of testing in the wilderness like your fathers, and goes on to say, take care, lest there be in any of you an evil or unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort one another every day, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So instead of falling away, we must draw closer to God. And we can do this many ways. We can do this through prayer and fellowship and learning or discipleship. But the main way that the psalm and the author of Hebrews points us towards connecting with God is through worship. So the first way to apply this psalm practically in our lives, commit to right worship. Commit, make every effort to worship God according to these values. Come to Him with joyful hearts, with humble and reverent minds, and with obedient actions. Do not allow your stresses or anxieties, your struggles, your doubts, your busyness, or your personal preferences to keep you from being committed to worship. Hebrews goes on to say that while the promise of entering His rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not befit them, because they were not united by faith with those who listened. This is the second application. Worship together. See, worship was not intended to be something that we do alone. It's not enough to listen to a famous preacher on a podcast or to listen to Christian worship music on your own. While you're driving, there's a communal aspect to worship. There's a responsibility in this community to hold fast to one another, to help each other worship, to connect with God, and to avoid falling away or missing out on this rest. See, the Christian life, I think, sometimes appears to us to be an individual sport, right? Because we make such a big deal about how we all need to have a personal relationship with Jesus. But in some ways, it's a team sport, because we are not alone in that quest. Our understanding of worship should be distinct from so many other things we do. Worship is not like a community meeting or a bonfire where we gather with friends and we sing songs and we leave feeling better about ourselves. It's a place of transformation through God's presence and God's power. It's a place where we enter as ourselves and we leave reoriented and better resembling God and better obeying His statutes and commandments. We do not leave the same. We must leave changed.